Everybody, want to talk about the Heart Sutra? I know we know it. We are talking about beginner's mind. And so if you know the Heart Sutra, let's do it again anyway and pretend you don't know it. Because I don't know, I've been chanting the Heart Sutra for a long time. I don't know how long you've been chanting it. But it changes over time. It's gotten very sweet to me lately. And I thought I'd talk about it. But it's going to be more of a autobiographical tour of the Heart Sutra than a historical tour. I'll do some context. But first, can I read you the Heart Sutra like you never heard it before? It's worth it. Here's the Heart Sutra in the version they have it in English. And it is, just to be clear, because I might be entirely or partially responsible for this, but we've been chanting the Great Heart of Perfect Wisdom Sutra forever. It is not the Great Heart of Perfect Wisdom Sutra. It is the Heart of the Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra. So I'm so sorry if you've had it wrong in your brain. If your Zen friends look at you funny when you said it like that and judged you, my bad. But we're going to fix all the handouts. Anyway, this is the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, or neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. Therefore, given emptiness, there is no form. No sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch. No object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance. Neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death. No suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. All Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on prajnaparamita, and thereby attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the prajnaparamita as the great miraculous mantra, the great bright mantra, the supreme mantra, the incomparable mantra which removes all suffering and is true, not false. Therefore, we proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra, the mantra that says Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhi Svaha. That's the Heart Sutra. That was fun to read, like that. I know, you chant so often, it's kind of like doing the Pledge of Allegiance or the Our Father if you were raised Catholic, where it just becomes like water and it's just, you're not even thinking about it. So when I remember to think about it, I get my mind blown all over again every time. I'm like, oh, wow. This is really good. But it's the most common thing chanted in all Mahayana schools. I think all Mahayana schools chant it as like the main piece. I know all Zen schools and all Chinese Chan schools, it's like the daily, it's the everyday thing, which I thought was funny at first. So if you don't know the background on it, we don't know exactly where it comes from. It might have been cobbled together in China and it might come from India. It's definitely a condensing of, there's a whole series of sutras called the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the perfection of wisdom in so many lines, if you've heard of these. And they're all similarly either expanded or condensed version of basically the same idea. But there's one in 120,000 lines. I have not read that one. That's entirely too long. I think there's an 84,000 line one. There's a 60-some thousand line one. They get shorter until the Tibetans, it's one of those good solid Buddhist jokes, they have the Prajnaparamita Sutra in one syllable. The syllable is A. Now you know. That's all you need to know is A, apparently. But they're all kind of doing the same thing. So the very, very brief background of Mahayana Buddhism is, we don't know where Mahayana Buddhism comes from. They used to teach that it started probably around the year zero. So if Buddhism starts in the year negative 500 BCE, then Mahayana comes about several hundred years later. And that just kind of made sense to people. But then the more you look into it, the more research they've done, the more archaeology they've done, that got shakier and shakier. And every time they do more and more research, the dates of Mahayana gets pushed back to where the recorded history of it seems to start about the same time as the recorded history of what we would call early Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism. Historically, you really can't separate which one came first. Literarily, if you look at it, to me, it's quite obvious Mahayana came second. Because the other funny thing about chanting this every day is it's incredibly petty that we chant this every day. So if you read this thing, you might notice, eagle-eyed Buddhist theorists out there might notice things you recognize. The five aggregates, for one thing, Murasan, sensation, perception, formation, consciousness, and all these things about the eyes and the touch and the object of mind. Those were all classic Buddhist Abhidharma networks. So when not the original Buddhists, let's call them second wave Buddhists, after Buddha died, there became kind of this like Baroque phase of Buddhism, where they just wanted to like understand reality. So they broke all of reality down into all these complex matrices and networks and ways to explain every facet you could possibly get. So they would usually start with like, so you have an eye, you have an eye consciousness, you have a sensation of mind consciousness, all these little things that you could use as points of meditative awareness if you wanted to just kind of like break down your sense of self. But that got a little overblown and ridiculous, like most things do. And so Mahayana came along as the wipe it all clean. And the really petty argument that came up was, so Buddha said you have no self. And these dharmic networks, like the object of mind, the realm of mind consciousness, of eye consciousness, the five aggregates, their argument was, okay, there's no you, but those things are real. Your eye consciousness is a real solid thing. And the Mahayanas were like, no, it's not. That's empty too. It sounds real silly. But that's all this thing is saying is, no, it's not. It's just kind of a petty furthering of that one argument they had in probably the year 200 BC. So it's kind of silly we're still chanting it, which is why I think it's funny that I like it so much. But when you let go of that, what else happens? So I guess that's all the historical background I'm going to give you. And that's my kind of unresearched memory of it after having studied it for a long time. But I think it's pretty accurate. My first encounter with it was at a temple in Brooklyn. I had heard the word Zen and it sounded pretty cool. I was into Buddhism. I was going to Ethan Nickturn's group in New York, which was very casual. And I didn't really understand the religiousness of Buddhism. I thought all groups were just kind of like punk rock hangouts, sit in groups. I don't know what I thought Buddhism was. I certainly didn't think it was what I walked into in that temple, which was what we don't look like here, but what some Zen centers look like, which was a bunch of people in robes doing a complicated ritual with big pillars and columns and a huge altar, and they're all chanting in unison. And I was creeped the hell out. I thought it was a cult and it was weird, and I didn't know how I got there. Luckily, and this is why I always tell people that you should do this too, I was probably ready to walk out when they started chanting, like, I have no idea what's going on. And somebody walks over and hands me a book and shows me the page. And I was like, okay, fine, I guess I'll stick around. Be that person. Always be that person at the Zen Center. Show the person next to you the page. Don't let people feel stupid, because they will leave. And they're not wrong. We're jerks if we don't show them what page we're on or what's going on. Our shit's weird. But then I'm sitting there chanting this thing, and I was still creeped out by the environment. I didn't know I was going to go back. But the words on the page were just, I was just so happy to see it. Like, nothing has ever made me that happy to read. It was just like, to me, it was the first sane and honest thing I'd ever read written down. And it's like this kind of thing I had always kind of known. And everyone else had told me, no, that's crazy. And so I was trying to believe them my whole life. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, thank God, I can stop pretending. And I was just so grateful that somebody told me the truth. And then angry that somebody had written down the truth 2,000 years ago, nobody had told me about it. And ever since, I've been on a crusade against Western philosophy for not having noticed somebody wrote this. But one reason I wanted to give this talk is I've never been able to quite articulate to myself what I found. So I'm coining the word sanifying, for it made me feel sane about reading it. Because even when you parse it down, it's kind of weird. I knew emptiness spoke to me. I'd been a fan of the Tao. Like, Ethan's group was much more, I'm not get too into it. But if you the early stages of Tibetan Buddhism, which is what Ethan's group is kind of based on, are like Theravadan Buddhism. They're trying to, they don't quite go the emptiness level. They're still trying to like prep you and train you to be a happier, nicer person. And so I was studying the Tao on my own, and the Tao is very, very heavily steeped in emptiness and how to work with emptiness and the philosophy of it. And I always kept being like, this Buddhism stuff is great, but it's missing something. It's missing that joke. And then I got this, and I was like, oh, cool, Buddhism has it too. So I think that was part of it. But going back further to make it personal, when I showed up to Ethan's group, what I like so much about his group, because I was coming at it from an activist mindset, especially like real anti-corporate, real anti-marketing. I was reading a lot of Adbusters. Remember that stuff. And they had that term, you guys know this term, colonization of the mind, where the corporations have colonized your mind with their ideas and their marketing. And what I liked about Ethan's version of Buddhism was by deconstructing a lot of your desires, the things you've input, your conditioning, it was kind of like a direct way of addressing that. I was like, oh, cool. Like, this guy's got a program to help me decolonize my mind. Awesome. But I still saw it in those terms of like, I don't know, me against them. This is going to fix that problem of that. And then I read this, and even the Tao is it's a pretty political book. It's got an argument. It was written to kind of be a political treatise for a certain time and place. This is not that. Well, I guess it is in Buddhist terms, but philosophically, this is not that. This says the problem is not the corporations, or this doesn't say the problem is the corporations. This is coming from the standpoint of what I understand now is true Buddhism, that if the corporations got to you, it's because you wanted them to. If marketing works on you, you wanted something, and they're just filling the desire that you're going to fill with something else anyway. And this got to the heart of why were we ever stressed about anything in the first place? I mean, for me, it's like going back to being a kid. I grew up with a lot of conflict and a lot of stress. And it's probably stuff that a lot of people grow up with. And so I guess I grew up with like, why does any of this shit matter? You know, why is this worth whatever we're putting into it? That was always my question, which is where the Heart Sutra comes in. It's, you weren't wrong. You weren't crazy. They're crazy. And Buddhism is like, well, that's rude. That's not how I mean it. But Buddhism, like whatever, that stuff you're trying to get that you think is so important, what is it based on? What do you think it's going to improve? That's my personal diagnosis of why this stuff spoke to me. And all I know is that, yeah, when I read it, it just felt like no one ever told me the truth before. And I was just really, really grateful. And I think that's kind of when I committed to Zen. Honestly, ACZC is still that same project to me. If you don't notice, like, I wanted that heart not in that setting. And so that's kind of where I ended up, is the casual version of here's the Heart Sutra. That's what I've been doing ever since. There was a teacher in New Orleans. He was a funny guy. He was from a Deshimara lineage, which were kind of funny lineages. But his monks would always, they only ever had ever chanted it in the Sino-Sanskrit version, the version that hasn't been translated for a few countries or centuries. And when his monks asked him why he wouldn't translate it, his snarky answer was, you wouldn't understand it anyway, which I guess is technically true. But I don't know. That's my question for you all. Is that true? It sounds good and pithy and Zen, but is he right? I often wonder. I did then memorize it. And I remember memorizing Japanese was the whole process for me because, you know, a lot of places do chant the Japanese version. So if you're going to stick around with Zen, if you're going to go travel different centers and stuff, it can be worth knowing it. It's just kind of easier and it's more fun once you kind of know it and don't have to read off the card. But it wasn't easy to do. I don't know if you guys have memorized any of this Japanese stuff yet. But memorizing gibberish, I'd never tried to memorize gibberish before. But it's like a whole thing where you just can't think about it. There's no logic or rhyme or reason to it. I had a friend who memorized pi. She was incredibly smart, but she knew it, which is kind of spoiled the thing. Well, at an open mic, she wrote a song where she just sang as much of pi as you can remember, which isn't really like 120 digits you can remember of pi. But it's so show-off, you're like, you're kind of ruining your bit by doing your bit. Anyway, I feel like memorizing the Heart Sutra is kind of like memorizing pi. There's nothing your mind can do to grab onto to make it make sense. There's no formula that can work for that. I couldn't find any mnemonic devices to work. You just got to rote memorize a bunch of gibberish. And it took me a few years, actually. I got the first part down in a couple months, just going over and over it. And then I quit for like 2 years. I was like, nah, I'll finish it fine. And I finally finished it. But that was really good because that's how these things work. And I'm always saying like about Dogen, like just let it go. Let your brain go and don't try to stay cognate with it. And that's where things sink in. Like even though it was gibberish, I did know the English words. And while I was memorizing it, like, I had all kinds of poetry just flowing out, like all about that word gone and the emptiness stuff. Like it really was sinking in because I do think that process of, I guess, shut up and do, which is kind of what New Orleans was saying. He's like, when he says you wouldn't understand it anyway, it kind of sounds like I know and you don't. But to be fair, he didn't say that. He's just saying it's not intelligible, which he's not wrong. Even though it's very personal to me and I feel like it does mean a lot to me, it's not intelligible. That's not how it works. And so then I had a funny experience a few years ago. I've done way more funerals and weddings, which was kind of sad for my priest career. But we had somebody come in for a while who just really wanted us to do his wedding. And so we were going over the ceremony with them beforehand. And since he was kind of more of a casual practitioner, I guess typically at any kind of ceremony, you would just do the heart surgery, is what we're supposed to do. But I assumed, okay, we'll soften it for like a lay version. They've incorporated this loving kindness sutra into a lot of Zen literature in America, even though it's a Theravadin sutra. They use it a lot. San Francisco started bringing it in because I think because Americans wanted something that said love in it somewhere, something that had the word kindness and love in it was lacking in the canon. But we're going over it. And the day before I was like, I don't want to do the loving kindness sutra instead because I'm reading it. And the funny thing about the loving kindness sutra is it's telling you how to be a loving person, but it's kind of strict. It's kind of admonishing. It's kind of assuming you're kind of a jerk and you need it to tell you how to be a nicer, more loving person. And all of a sudden, I didn't want to be the stern parent at a wedding telling these people, like, be nice to each other. They're probably, it seemed like they seem very happy. They seem like great people. They seem lovely to each other. They don't need me to tell them to be loving to each other. And then I read the Heart Sutra again. I was like, no, I think this is it. I think this is the actual loving poem. I think that's the first time it struck me as a loving poem. But I'm going to read you one more version of it. This is the version. This is not a legitimate translation. I have looked over it with the Chinese. I don't think it's too far off. And I mostly took a lot of it from the Scottish Zen Center, the Glasgow Zen Center. This is what I call my barroom version. So I took the Glasgow version and I just made it so that it sounds to me like what it's saying. So it actually sounds like poetry. I have done a couple open mics, which never goes well. I did it at a comedy open mic once, and it was just the most awkward moment in the world. No one seemed to get the joke, despite being so funny. They weren't that funny. Neither was I. Anyway, so this is my barroom version. This is the way I would like to, if I'm just going to speak it, this is how I would say it. She who hears the cries of the world, Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion while sitting in perfect wisdom, clearly saw the emptiness of all things, and so ended all suffering. Form is not separate from emptiness. Emptiness no different than form. The forms themselves are emptiness, the emptiness itself, the forms. Feelings and thought, awareness and will, are empty. All the ways of being are empty. They are not made or lost, are not right or wrong, do not rise or fall. As all these are empty, eyes and ears, nose and tongue, body and mind are gone. Sight and hearing, smell and taste, touch and thought are gone. All the ways of knowing are gone, and not knowing is also gone. And the end of not knowing, and the outcomes of not knowing, wasting away, death, are all gone. Hurt is gone. Illness and its cures are gone. Suffering and the end of suffering, wisdom and its attainment, are all gone. With nothing to attain, the bodhisattva, resting in perfect wisdom, loosens her bonds, looses all fear, and realizes perfection. All the awakened, those already gone, those here now and those yet to come, through this perfection of wisdom becomes this perfection. So know this perfection as these words, the great words that end all suffering, are wisdom's end stop, truth beyond mistaking. Know that we can speak this perfect wisdom, say it in a single word, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone to the other shore beyond gone. Wake up, wake up. That's how I like to say it. And that's the gate, gate, paragate. That's what it means. Bodhisvaha means enlightenment, yay. So, it's a common salutation at the end of an Indian chant. But so wake up would be, that's what bodhisvaha means also. But the word gone I took throughout it from the Scottish were doing that. They use the word hollowness for emptiness, which is technically correct, but I felt like it put something a little different to say hollowed. But in a Scottish brogue, it sounds lovely. The hollowness. I can't do a Scottish brogue, but trust me, it's lovely. Go look it up and give them credit. But I liked gone because it turns it into what it actually is to me. Like when I read it that day at the temple, it wasn't just that it was a philosophy that I had always known was true. It's that I was sitting there with my eyes, ears, and tongue chanting, no eyes, no ears, and tongue. What I'm doing is I'm just cleansing away the preconception of whatever the hell I think is happening. And then you're just like stopped dead right there. And the only thing that's happening is what's happening. And so to me, gone is an active choice of, no, I'm here. And that's where to me it becomes a loving thing. Because it's dropping your expectations, it's dropping your needs and wants and what you're putting on, what I'm putting on the world, what I expect out of the world. Just be like, all that's gone, I'm here with you now. And that to me is, it's hard to do, but that's to me what actual love is. It's not always what you want it to be. It's not always pleasant. It's saying, all right, I'm here with you. And that struck me as a much much more loving and kind thing to say than be nice to each other that day at the wedding. And it was really great. They loved it. He was really like, yeah, do it. He also wanted me to wear the funny Pope hat, which I'm not allowed to wear yet, but he was really disappointed that I didn't come in a funny Pope hat, which I thought was funny. I thought he was going to think I was too weird and religious. He's like, no, man, do it up. Wear the whole thing. But, so yeah, that really changed the way I looked at it after that. And then, so I do it a bunch at funerals too, of course. We do it for memorials. Whenever I pass a dead animal, I usually chant it for him or a dying animal. And it always kind of has that bittersweet love character to me now. And reading it at a funeral, to me, is actually really powerful. Because if you're going to say something for loved ones lost, it doesn't say anything is lost. It almost says this is what we all always were. And that's, I don't know how to square that. But it makes a lot of sense in the middle of the ceremony. And it's exactly what I would want to say that I never would have thought to have said if somebody hadn't written it 2,000 years ago. And then, so in my barroom version, it's Perfection of Wisdom, which isn't really explained. The old versions, it's still left as Prajnaparamita. It's funny because it's everything is empty, let go of everything. But it gives you this one line, this one thing. It's like everything but this. This is the answer. And then when you look up what Prajnaparamita is, it's emptiness. And so you're right back to where you started. But again, but I like it said as perfection. Again, I don't know if I'm beating this into the ground. If people don't like it, don't want to hear it, or are just over the conversation. But the everything is all perfect thing. To me, it's not a corollary that I'm ever going to prove to you that everything is fundamentally perfect or is perfect the way it is. But I proved to myself, A, I think it's reality. Things couldn't be any different. But also it's a choice. Again, it's that choice of saying gone. It's that I'm not going to expect right now that things should have been any other way. Because that would be delusional and also just gets in the way. Also, it's kind of rude. I've been really working on, because I still work with my anger. I still sit with a lot of anger. I still have a lot of conversations in my head. But the whole not blaming thing is really sinking in. Like when I get those angers and I get upset, when I have these conversations in my head, it's becoming harder and harder to rationalize blame of anybody or anything for being the way they are. No matter how bad, like name it. Blame doesn't seem to cut it anymore. There's a lot of things we just accept are the way they are. But then we want to judge. And that was just an idea somebody had once, this whole good and evil duality thing. It was a philosophical idea, 1,000 BC, Zoroastrianism. We all got it from there. Went to Christianity and Judaism and Islam, and we all just kind of forgot that was a choice we made to decide that evil is a choice that some people make, and they must be wrong and bad, and they must be stopped. I mean, yes, no, stop bad things. That's still true. But do it with love. But like in Buddhist terms, I like it so much better. It's a little patronizing, but the idea is just that if somebody is an asshole, they've had it rough and they're going through something tough and they're making it worse for themselves as they are for anybody else that they're hurting. And that must really suck for them. And so they deserve just as much of our care and compassion as anybody else suffering from the blows they're dealing out. That's hard, but that feels like that's a hard truth I want to wrestle with. Cause I believe it. But I'm not always knee-jerk there yet, you know? Anyway, that's my speech. This is my autobiographical tour of the Heart Sutra. I would love to hear how you all heard it, hear it, and what it does for you. I would love to hear your stories of the Heart Sutra.
I've been hearing this my whole life, and I remember like hearing it in a room full of people in brown robes. And I think as a kid, it was like really magical because it's kind of like this humbling thing, this like equalizing factor. Like they're grown ups and I'm a kid. It's like, but none of us have like any of these things. And so that was kind of magical. And then I think what is interesting, it becomes a little creepy. Like it's one thing to hear it in a community and have everybody around, but to have that like resounding in you and then to be alone and not have proof that you have like eyes, or, you know, because there's no one like reflecting that back to you was like eerie. And so sometimes I feel like I still think about those two things. I don't have a question necessarily, but I really liked the second version. You said you wrote the second version.
I massaged the Glasgow version into this one.
I just feel like the second version has like more of a sense of a speaker, like a narrator. Like there's something in the first one that feels like, who's saying it? It just feels like stricter. I don't know how to say it, but there's something really sweet and like encouraging. Maybe it's also how you read it, but I don't know. It's really neat to hear it that way. I feel that I prefer it.
Well, thank you. I'll take the compliment. Mostly I didn't write it, but I do like speaking the second version. But one thing I took out of it was the pettiness. You'll notice all the stuff like the five aggregates and stuff. Because I feel like that's a dead argument. None of you care about the Sarvastivadins and the Mahayanans arguing in the second century BC about whether or not dharmas are intrinsically real or not. But what they were actually talking about, is your sensation real? Is your perception real? I don't know. That's another one of my questions for you all. Did you all wrestle with that as a kid? For me, I guess, along with conflict, I also had a lot of time we moved a lot and we took a lot of traveling. So just like staring out a car window for hours at a time, nothing much going on. And I'd be like, am I going crazy? Was I already crazy? What the hell is that thought? Wait, am I really sensing things? How can I prove any of this is real? And I just kind of go a little weird, which is kind of like what we do in Zazen, right? So again, when somebody's like, no, it's not. I was like, oh, that's a much simpler answer than every convoluted way I came up to like prove that my perception of things are real. But your existential crisis around it, that's real. There's no way to, that's a big part of it. For me personally, for some reason, in Buddhism, I never encountered that. When I was younger, when we talk about the difference between drugs and the end of a 3-day retreat, it gets you to some similar places. But for some reason, when I did it with drugs and psychedelics, it took me to that like dark despair of being on the branch by yourself of emptiness. Versus whenever I've done it in meditation, it can be very similar feelings and see a lot of crazy things. But I never minded. It always felt connected. It felt more like interdependence than the pit of despair. And I don't know why. But I do think going through the pit of despair might be part of the process for everybody. Good luck. I'm sorry. You're welcome.
On that note, this is beautiful. But I struggle with the word emptiness, like it has a connotation, and I think it has that pit of despair connotation for me. But then I love this idea of form, and the word that's not in here, but the word that I feel like sums up all of this is fullness. And that is like incredibly comforting, that it's nothing and everything all at the same time. I volunteer for hospice, and you have to think about death a lot, and this to me is one of the most beautiful commentaries for death that I've seen. I come from a background where heaven and hell and good and bad are pretty intensely, they're like, oh, we're sorry they died and we really hope they're in a better place, but it can have a really pressurized, really difficult connotation for a lot of people, especially those who truly believe that someone has been condemned to a pit of despair, right? So in my background and around death, it's been a really tricky thing. And this frees you from all of that in the most beautiful way. And so I want to sit with it. I think it's really beautiful. But I'm sitting with that emptiness and that fullness and just that full circle. And I like what you said about that pit of despair versus that fullness and that calm and that peace that comes when we all say that it's empty and we're all okay with it together.
Yeah, that's nicely said, especially the Sangha practice stuff part. But I like how kind of like you're saying democratizing the adults to the kids. It also kind of democratizes living the dead, which is a nice thing to do at a funeral. But yeah, that fullness emptiness thing, I really like, and I think most of the good Buddhist pieces I really see as, again, they're not ideas to learn. They're usually active training tools. And so I've noticed that a lot of times, maybe that's why I didn't go with hollowness, because I felt like hollowness was a way to soften the blow of emptiness. And it's kind of like when people, I always bring this one up, but when people want to soften the blow of the first noble truth being all things are suffering. And that really is the best way to, bitter might be a better translation, kind of sucky. It's that the word is just the opposite of sweetness. Dukkha is all it means. But so it wasn't pleasant. There's no way to massage that to be pleasant. It was written to be, to me, provoking. Because the thing is, we do have, if we're going philosophically, we do have thusness, and that's the corollary emptiness. They're both the same thing. And thusness is fullness. It's things just as they are. It's all of this. It's the all one thing. It's like the beautiful one we want to believe in. But the problem with that is it's really easy to think that that's what you're dwelling in when you're actually dwelling in an egoified version, a projected version of what you wish the world was. And so I'm pretty sure the choice of the word emptiness is designed to push you through that pit of despair, which is kind of assumed that if you haven't reckoned with that yet, you're not really going to get fullness. And so, yeah, it's not propositional emptiness. It's, hey, are you willing to confront the nagging, gnawing, empty chasm that is letting yourself, as you've known it, fall away? I haven't heard that to be an entirely pleasant process for many people. Maybe I'm wrong. But fullness is there too. Hey, it's also beautiful.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the first Zen retreat I did was, I think, March 2019 or April, March, I think it was. And the focus was the Heart Sutra. And so I was like brand new to Zen. I wasn't new to meditating, but I was new to Zen. And I was very new to these teachings in a lot of ways. And it did not make sense to me at all. I was like, what is this? And so I sort of had the opposite reaction where like you heard it and you're like, finally sanity. And I heard it and was like, what? And it took a long time for it to make sense to me. Years, I would say. And it's funny, like a thing that I've been thinking a lot about, what we're going to talk about tomorrow, I think, is just some reflections on having been, it's just been over 5 years since I started coming here all the time. And the difference between just hearing something and actually like learning it in your body and in your bones. And I think for me, you know, probably when I moved into this place in 2020, then it was like suddenly I went from meditating. Before I moved in, I would come Mondays and Saturdays, I think, were my regular spots. And I probably had only chanted the Heart Sutra a handful of times on retreat and on like half day sits and stuff. I don't know, maybe like 10 or 20. But I just started chanting every Friday because I came to all the ceremonies every Friday. And I guess gradually it sunk in some way. I mean, along with the other teachings. And I think it's really beautiful now. And it's just kind of, I was the kid that knew the whole Catholic Mass the whole time. And then I had this whole thing when I came back. I basically got high and went to midnight mass like 5 years after I left home and just stopped going to church altogether for various reasons that I didn't buy it. But it was kind of wild to be like knowing all these things by heart and then also actually being like sort of seeing them for the first time. I think at some point that happened to me with the Heart Sutra. Mm-hmm. Where I was like, wow, this is really beautiful. And I never really understood it. And I don't know what point in time that was. But yeah, it's kind of... I remember the other night during the Dharma Combat ceremony when we chanted it, I was like, this is so great.
Yeah. Thanks, Sarah. You know how we used to always say around here that the old bride used to say the talks are dessert for the doing the zazen? I think I completely agree, except that I would add the chanting. To me, the real... Where I've seen people here and in myself, because I say like I got it right, but I did, it's changed over time. But a lot of it's like living and then chanting it every day without really thinking about it. And something slips in the places where it actually matters. I really do agree that mostly these talks are just here to entertain people to keep you coming back and practicing. Mm-hmm. I just think the one thing that America's kind of lost or isn't getting enough of is that chanting and oral transmission of these teachings was the ancient way of passing them along. Especially like I've seen with Heart and Difference in Quality, and I've had a lot of people say the same thing that one, I don't even think I tried to get it at first because I was just kind of annoyed that I had to chant it. Mm-hmm. It seemed like some old man crap that I didn't really feel like doing.
That was my version of the Heart. Like when I heard that, I was like, holy shit, this is amazing.
Yeah, that one took me a while. But when it sunk in, it's like, oh, that's revelatory. But like, when I had noticed it sunk in, it was a long process for that to actually, like, something had to have shifted. And so I really think we're just trying to entertain you long enough for the zazen and your life and the coming back and the sangha. Mm-hmm. And then the chanting will explain it to you, but it might take a few years for it to sink in what it's been explaining to you. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for being here. Hopefully everyone either got the email or found there's the updated schedule.